Hello there, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and the Thinking Fellows is part of the 1517 podcast network of shows. You can go to 1517.org/podcast or / podcast. I know. Slash podcasts.
Just say slash.
Just say slash podcast.
I always look at it as a forward slash, but some people have told me it's back.
Well, what I've learned is that you can actually orient your slash either direction and it all works the same. But yeah,
so slash podcast.
So 1517.org/podcasts. And from there, you can see 20 different shows and also explore the rest of 1517.org, which has loads of blogs, conference signups, and other speaking events that you may be able to attend that may be in your local area. And then, you know, links to things like videos. You can also go check out video at our YouTube channel. We're building up our library and playlists of video over there. So if you're a subscriber of one of the podcasts, it may be worth subscribing on the YouTube channel as well. We have a couple of exclusive types of content over there that you may want to check out. I'm joined by my dad today. I forgot that part on the beginning of the episode on Father's Day. So
we're not doing our historic Father's Day episode.
We're not doing I mean, we could, but
it's all right. We did something else.
Yeah. So we are going to, let's see here. We are going to talk about the Augsburg Confession. Now, at the beginning of our we did a grand view of the Book of Concord a couple months ago, and we talked about the Augsburg Confession a little bit in there. We've done other episodes on it as well, and now we're making our way around to it again. And unlike the last section where we did the small catechism and the large catechism separately, we are going to pair together the Augsburg Confession and the Apology to the Augsburg Confession because, well, they share numbering and subject matter. And so we will combine those, so we'll be able to give you an overview of articles from the Augsburg Confession and then Melanchthon's defense of those articles against the confutation in the Apology. So you were going to say something?
Oh, no. Go for it. Well, continue with your introduction.
Yeah, continue with the introduction. Well, I think we should do a bit of a historical introduction again, maybe a grand overview of particularly the Augsburg Confession. Why does the Augsburg Confession matter today? Type of question as well.
I just made my students write a paper on that.
And we also might just like ask, like, this is the first of the confessions in the Book of Concord that was not later like adopted as a confession, but actually like written purposefully and presented as a confession of faith, right? So the small catechisms and the large catechism are confessions of faith, but they weren't presented to be signed on to as a collected volume of confessions originally.
No, and I think I tried to encourage you to name this episode A Crisis in Christianity. Not just to get more downloads, although it's a good title.
I do think it's a good title.
But because the Augsburg Confession really does represent the response to what had by 1530 become a literal crisis in Christianity. We've done introductions to the Augsburg Confession on this show before where we'll say that this is not just a theological movement, it's not just a theological thing, that there are political influences at play here. And there certainly are. I mean, the Muslim Turks are threatening invasion of the west of the Holy Roman Empire at various points. And the Emperor Charles V really is trying to solidify sort of what you call, we in 20th century would have called war guarantees, you know, that if they are invaded, that certain princes and electors and rulers will send troops in aid type thing, and is worried that with the religious strife that is currently occurring in the Holy Roman Empire, especially in by these weird evangelicals up in what we'd call northern Germany, that he's really not going to get the help that he would otherwise get, which is why you get sort of that line in the introduction to the Augsburg Confession that references the need for not just theological, but really political and military unity. But it's a crisis because it's you know, I think when you introduce the Augsburg Confession, you kind of have to go, if you accept 1517 as the beginning to the Reformation, sort of Luther's 95 Theses and the presentation on the door of the Castle Church in Wittenberg, if you accept that as the beginning, one of the things to realize about the Augustana is that the Diet of Augsburg occurs 13 years after that. Mm-hmm. And in the in-between, there is quite a bit of tumult. I wouldn't just say turmoil, but it's literally a turning over of theological beliefs, even though they're technically still Roman Catholic. Their theological beliefs have changed, and there's been a publishing melee coming out of the Wittenbergers or the Evangelisch up in northern Germany that is really causing a crisis, because it's causing people to question long-held accepted belief, and primarily the long-held accepted belief that the church is the ultimate authority. And not just the church, but there had been a movement really away from conciliatory authority, in other words, the authority of councils and the role they played on determining theological matters, to papal authority, and sort of giving the Pope the ultimate fiat decision-making over this. And when Luther comes on the scene and this whole sort of Reformation begins, it becomes obvious that other opinions are taking hold in a way that they, theological opinions, in a way that they weren't previously able to do. And a lot of this has to do with the protection that Luther, throughout his life, receives from his various electors, but mm-hmm. especially early on. And the fact that it's not as easy to burn Luther at the stake as it was, say, Jan Hus 100 years earlier.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's good to establish that there's a reason for that.
Yeah.
And that has to do with that he has actual, you know, political protection, that the sword is actually working in his favor.
That's right. Yeah.
Where for Hus it wasn't.
Well, yeah, and sometimes you'll get people asked the question, why was Luther so sort of deferent to political authority when he was causing a revolution? And the fact is, he wasn't causing a revolution, and his local political, not even local, I guess we would call it his federal political authority, not that they were in a federal system, but sort of his president, his elector, protected him his whole life. The sword, like, that's a good way to say it, the sword worked in his favor, even though he remained under the ban and was technically an outlaw, according to the emperor. In his land, he was protected.
Yeah, and that just goes a long way to this. Okay, so 1530 is when this is presented at the Diet of Augsburg. Now, this is essentially the first of the Protestant, more generally speaking, right, confessions, and begins sort of an era of confessionalization. I do think it's important to point out that, you know, Augsburg happened some 30 or 40 years before the first, you know, Calvinistic or Reformed confessions.
Not quite that long.
Like 63.
Okay. I'm thinking institutes. I'm giving them. They're not confessional, but they're highly political, theologically influential in that sort of in that sort of vein.
But that would be like the Loci, right? Which
even
predates Augsburg and Calvin by a considerable number of years. And so, you know, this is really sort of the spark towards this, and in that sense has sort of a who's who in the zoo flavor, right? So they're presenting this doctrine of beliefs and then basically getting people to say yes to it, right? Or yes, me too.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
the Augsburg Confession is interesting as a confessional document, and it's different from the Apology as a confessional document too. And actually, confessionalism as an ism is emerging now. If we're talking about 1530, this is just
Augsburg's a spark of that.
Yeah, Augsburg is a spark of that. It, you know, there's creedal. There's obviously the Roman Catholic Church is a creedal church, and it's informed by the decisions of the councils that brought us the, you know, now three ecumenical creeds. But that's different too, because that's a group of, you know, that's sort of in terms of the Apostles' Creed and accepting of the tradition that this is a quote unquote statement of faith of the apostles. Even with the Athanasian Creed, it's different.
Yeah, that wasn't at a council adopted. But
the Nicene Creed itself, you know, is accepted at a council, and then the council goes on for a long time. That's another story. But this is different because this is sort of like the confessionalism that's brought about because of this crisis.
Well, and I think those creeds, I think, like, Augsburg's the first time in a really long time that a crisis drives the need for these statements of faith again, right?
Right. And so, and in fact, they were asking, the reformers were asking for a council, and they got a diet.
Yeah.
You know, they were, I mean, one of the big arguments was, we don't think the Pope and his sort of advisors alone have the ability to say that this is non-Christian, that what we're teaching is non-Christian or heresy. And you even within the Augsburg Confession, you get those both in the Creeds and Confessions class. I say there's a distinction between heresy and heterodoxy, right? Heresy is me looking at you and saying, what you believe is so wrong, you're not a Christian.
Yeah.
Heterodoxy is me saying, I think your doctrine of baptism is wrong.
Well, and let's
But you're still a Christian.
Let's give people who maybe don't know the difference between a council and a diet a modern picture here. It's like asking for a board of directors meeting and getting thrown into a lawsuit. Like... And getting drawn before court.
It's like asking for your legislators to come together and to pass a law, and instead what they do is they come together and form a committee. You know, so it's like saying, hey, we've got this environmental issue, and we'd really like you to come together as legislators and pass some environmental protections in our area. We don't like that these companies are dumping sewage into our river. Please pass a law saying that they can't do that, right? Of course, this is America, so there's probably already 10,000 laws that say they can't do that. But
add another one. Why not?
Yeah, but instead what happens is the legislators go, oh, we're not sure we can deal with that right now, but we will we'll put this committee together.
We'll grant
now,
you a committee.
I mean, ironically, the emperor shows up to this committee meeting, and so it's maybe a little bit more than a committee, but I'm having a hard time coming up with a one-to-one here.
I've been... on but some committee meetings where the boss is there, but he doesn't really care.
Yeah, well, that's the Diet of Augsburg. Yeah. The boss is there, but he maybe fell asleep.
Yeah.
So that's what this is. And he's really interested in, you know, just making sure that they're going to send troops. So if he gets invaded. But in this crisis, though, you know, it's hard. The printing press. I mean, Luther is, if you take just Luther and Melanchthon and don't deal with anybody else, but some very influential works have come out of Wittenberg, which are just driving the Roman Catholic authorities crazy. I mean, you mentioned the catechism. So you have Luther's Small and Large Catechism, 1529, right? Just a year before the Augsburg Confession. But if you back up the three treatises in 1520, you know, three treatises are likely what got him dragged to the Diet of Worms, where he was called a heretic.
And they were hoping he would cool down, and he just sent three more firebombs across the line.
He writes one called On the Babylonian Captivity of the Church, you know, and that really made people happy. And so he's dragged to the Diet of Worms, another meeting in 1521, 9 years before the Diet of Augsburg, and he's called a heretic.
Yeah.
He's put under the imperial ban. He then...
I mean, when you call, you know, the church being held captive by Babylon, you're essentially saying that, like, papal authorities are basically a pagan mob.
Yeah.
Like, holding, or you right. know, yeah.
And then his response to that is, even though it's been declared that Jerome's Latin Vulgate is the only way that anybody who is a Christian should ever read the Bible, he, you know, gets sequestered at the Wartburg and he starts translating the Bible into German and into a German that he's basically going to invent. It's basically like, I think they call it Middle High German, but it's basically Luther's German.
Yeah, he really helps nail down vocabulary there, and that actually plays into like how some of the confessions develop and are written
right.
later, because even by 1580 the German theological vocabulary is not as precise as Latin, and so Latin versions of confessions originally written in German
start making their way up
for precision's sake.
Right. Heidelberg Disputations 2 years before that, really just driving people crazy, you know. Melanchthon's 1521, and then, you know, Loci is, you know, being used in what we would call seminaries everywhere by 1530 to educate pastors. Melanchthon's Greek vocabulary is being used everywhere to educate a fledgling humanist to read Greek. Reuchlin's, his great uncle's work in Hebrew is helping teach people Hebrew. All of this is leading to people reading the Bible in Greek and Hebrew instead of Latin. Or in now all of a sudden you have a dude that
in German
makes shoes for a living. He can read Romans in German and be like, what the heck? What's going on here? And it's just, stuff is going crazy. They have to do something. They're not sure they're going to get the political aid. This really is a crisis in Christianity. So it really is a crisis in the Christian empire that is the Holy Roman Empire. They have to do something. Council happens later. This Council of Trent, 1548 or something like that. That happens later. But for now, they're just not willing to do it. Seems easier, maybe more.
It seems like the quicker, hope is
quicker,
is
maybe
that,
since
like,
there's really is like this threat of invasion. Councils take a long time.
They're just trying to like each step figure out what might ease what's going on, what might slow down the angst, instead of going to like final solutions for everything, and so. Yeah, it seems like a natural extension of some of the debates or trials that have been had. Okay, let's...
Well, and councils take a long time. I mean, admitting here, just looked it up, because 1545 to 1563, that's a long time. I mean, you could be invaded in the meantime, right?
You could.
And that would not really help your crisis much. If all of a sudden you're all Muslim, your crisis in Christianity just got a lot worse. And so a diet, maybe you're thinking you can get a diet, knock out a diet in a couple weeks, couple months. And so that's what they do. And basically what happens is the evangelicals are called upon to write a confession of faith. They're actually asked to write a confession of faith or a document presenting their theological opinions. You know, they're given some promises both of safe passage and of safe acceptance and all this type of thing. Not agreement, but like, oh, hey, we're not going to like burn you at the stake at Augsburg if we don't agree with your theological opinions. So they're like, yeah, okay, well, that sounds like a fair deal. So they do it. There's a couple confessions. Confessionalism is becoming a thing, and people are starting to write confessions of faith. Didn't really have to do that before if you're Roman Catholic. You're like, hey, I'm Roman Catholic, so...
And we all are.
So, hey, pal, we're together on this. Even if we're not, and that's when you'd have, like, colloquians and disputations and stuff like that, which were mostly, like, medieval church scholar events.
Scholarly disagreements.
Yeah, scholarly. That are like, I mean, think about the most boring, like, PBS debate between two physicists that you've ever seen. This would have been what this is like, you know. The outcome of which... you know, probably doesn't affect the everyday lives of most people. This is different than that.
It'd be like watching C-SPAN all day.
Yeah, they're writing this stuff for the public. They're publishing it. The public is consuming it. They're teaching people how to read. I mean, it's like, they're like, we're publishing this stuff. And they're like, people are like, well, we can't read. And they're like, oh, great. We just opened 10,000 schools. So go learn to read. And they're like, oh, okay. So they go learn to read. And so it's really, and if you think about even from 1517 to 1530, they could have taught an entire generation to read by then.
Younger generation could be adults who were learning to read literally using things like the catechism.
Yeah. I mean, they start some of these school reforms early, 1520, right? So by 1530, you could have been a 10-year-old who went to one of these Latin schools or eventually gymnasiums that are started by the evangelicals. And by 1530, you're 20 years old, right? Yeah. You're attending the University of Wittenberg or another one of the universities.
You're 3 years older than Melanchthon was when he was publishing Greek grammars.
You're engaged, you know, you're in this. It matters to you in a way that, you know, a diatribe of 20 years earlier really wouldn't have. And so crisis, they come together. The documents that lead up to the Augsburg Confession are sort of collaborative works a little bit and not as comprehensive as the Augustana is. The Augustana is Melanchthon uses Marburg and Torgau to sort of work on the Augustana, but he writes it himself. I think there's tons of evidence for that. But he does collaborate with Luther insofar as he sends Luther. Luther can't go to Augsburg because he's
banned from traveling. So they're not going to promise that they won't burn Luther at the stake.
Yeah, no, they've already. His fate is already sealed in there.
So they're like, we won't burn Melanchthon and some of your other guys, but if Luther shows up dead, dead on arrival.
Yeah, so he stays. I don't know the distance between.
It took a couple days to get letters between him and Melanchthon back, of which we have and are translated. Several of them are. There's the Luther's Letters of Spiritual Counsel. That's translated, and in there, there's like three or four letters from Luther to Melanchthon in that volume, and I think there are other places as well. I think translated. That's just where I've read them most recently. And so you get to see some of the dialogue between Luther and Melanchthon, of which Luther calming Melanchthon down because he's worried that if something in there is wrong, that they are going to kill them all.
Yes.
Melanchthon seemingly doesn't really believe the promise that violence isn't going to be done against them.
I don't think any of them really do. But yeah. I think the elector seems... I could be wrong about that too.
Fairly confident.
A little more confident.
But Melanchthon sends questions to Luther asking if they should put some compromise in there so that they're not harmed.
Yeah. Death off Melanchthon. Luther's advice is
Luther's advice is like, well, die for the gospel if you have to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you can cut it later, but Luther's advice is like, nut up.
Yeah.
I mean, that's all interesting. Luther receives kind of final approval for the Augsburg Confession from Luther by letter, and that gives him a little bit more confidence. And then it's presented at the Diet. The date of the presentation is June 25th, 1530. It's presented at the Diet. It's read by a Dr. Bayer, who's sort of a character in sort of the Reformation, the story there. He speaks it very loudly. It's I mean, if you've ever, you and I have been to Germany in the summer, Caleb, it's warm.
It is warm.
Yeah. So
it's not unlike the Midwest. It's warm and a bit damp.
Yeah. And so the doors and the windows are, flung open to get a little bit of airflow. It's packed. There's people inside, outside. And he reads
it. No microphones.
He reads it as loudly as he can so that people even outside can hear it and take notes and sort of jot it down. There are some accounts that say that the emperor sleeps through the event, which, whatever. Meetings are boring.
He just wants to get to the point of, like, do I have your arms? Yay or nay?
I think fully expecting for that to be a yay as well. And then they hand it over. Here you go. They never see it again. So that's awkward.
It's in some catacombs below the Vatican. I know. Probably.
I think the Vatican should let us see it if they have it.
I bet they do, man. That's kind of the crazy thing.
Yeah. So it's handed over. There's a report of seeing, I think, the German sort of version. Not in somewhere in France, I think, in like 1680. I don't know how they knew it was that, but I think I've read that. And that's interesting. And then it's the Augsburg Confession is a wonderful document for a few reasons. I love to say, especially if you're talking about the first 21 articles, which are the positive articles, the last seven articles, 28 articles in total, last seven articles are kind of the... well, we don't agree with you on these things, articles. And there's some of that in the first 21, but the first 21s are positive presentations of evangelical doctrine for the most part. One that I think is completely unique about it is that other than Melanchthon's signature, it's signed by politicians. And so when you said what makes the Augsburg Confession a confessional document, it's that the political leaders that were protecting the reformers in 1530 are the ones that put their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honors at risk to sign it and to hand it to the emperor as their statement of faith. It wasn't on the whole the theologians who did that. Now, every confession that comes after that, for the most part,
mostly theologians.
Are theologians.
And sometimes really regional too.
Yeah. And so
particular cities.
That makes the Augustana an exceptionally unique confessional document. And it early on lends it a confessional authority of the confession of the evangelical church. This is sort of solidified in 1555 at another Diet of Augsburg, at the Peace of Augsburg, that really what happens in this time is that whatever religion your ruler is basically
what's
practiced in that land.
Yeah.
Unless you had this really exceptional ruler who was willing to let you still be a Roman Catholic.
He was a couple hundred years ahead of his time.
I mean, this would have been a really unique individual that thought that way. Because they believed in right and wrong in a way that we have a hard time now. I mean, if your ruler converted, it's likely because he thought the propositions, let's say, of the Augsburg Confession were right. That's the correct practice then.
In some ways, there's complaints about this, but in some ways, we today are the benefactors of hundreds of years of development of having less dependence directly on the people who live next door to you or even a couple blocks down from you, in a way that being different religions, even having adjacent but not 100% similar ethical standards between you and your neighbors, doesn't bring commerce and life to a halt in your city in a way where, when things are much more interwoven and there isn't technological import from all over the world benefiting you, that you really need to be on the same page with the people that you live next to.
Well, and you don't live in a democratic form of government. And so there's less of an expectation that you have sort of the freedom to make these types of decisions willy-nilly as you'd like. We like to say in our day and age that faith is personal. I have exceptions with that phrase in general. I think faith is both personal and corporate. The word is spoken and the spirit works.
It comes from other people.
It comes from other people to you, and it's supported by the preaching and forgiveness and administration of sacraments from other people to you throughout your life. And so,
if it was just personal, you wouldn't have large distinctions like Roman Catholic, Lutheran, or Reformed, or Calvinistic.
Even if some studies or some naming conventions on this are right, and there are thousands of denominations, you'd have many more thousands if it were just personal.
Right.
But it's presented. And the other thing that makes the Augsburg Confession unique is kind of the same thing that makes the early editions of the Loci Communis unique. That there's basically a race to the doctrine of justification, much in the same way that you see in Paul's epistle to the Romans. And it's just, you have a really brief sort of God.
Oh, yeah.
Article 1, right? Really brief. Sin, Article 2. Mm-hmm. And then you're going to get, arguably, I think by Article 3, you're at justification. Because
you're already talking about Christ.
You're at the doctrine of Christ. And then Article 4, you're at justification. And then from Article 5 on, at least through 14 and beyond, you're talking about how do I get this thing that is justification? How is it made personal? And you're going to land on some pretty simple answers. The preaching of the word and the administration of the sacraments by those who are rightly called to congregations to do that task.
Yeah.
And the answer is, I think, more simple than the opponents from the Roman Catholic side at Augsburg were expecting, because by 1530 there had been some enthusiast movements too by this point, movements that sort of relied on direct inspiration by the Holy Spirit and were more radical movements looking to overthrow society and government. And Luther was often wrongly identified with those movements. You'd have fully what the Lutherans would call Schwermerei movements, who were called Lutheran as a pejorative. When Luther, you know, Luther is so against this type of thing that during the Peasants' Uprising, at one point he's like, well, kill them all, you know, and it's like, this is how against this he is. And yet sort of as a pejorative, they're named Lutheran. And so I don't think that there is a complete understanding when the evangelicals get to the Diet of Augsburg of what it means, this sort of Lutheran pejorative actually means. And when it's laid out in the Augsburg Confession, and it's very much like, we hold the creed of Christianity, Article 1. We believe in the truly incarnate Christ and his redemptive work, Article 2. Article 3. Article 2, we have a very strong doctrine of sin.
I mean, you basically have set up the problem. I mean, and that's going to offend some people.
As quickly as you can.
But, like, the doctrine of God is used to help oppose to the doctrine of sin, set up the problem.
Oh, right. Completely holy God.
Right.
Doctrine 2, you're completely separate from him.
Yeah. And now 3, we're
Christ is your mediator.
You know, now we're at the solution of the problem. Yeah. And then after that is the sort of the what happens in this salvation.
Yeah, and they know that they're being accused of, like, trying to destroy the church. So you actually have articles that are like, the church, and then another article on, what is the church? And it's like, you're going to have a couple articles on...
So we're not destroying an institution.
Yeah, you have a couple articles on the ministry. They're like, well, this is the ministry.
Not everybody can be a pastor is sort of set up.
And then you can have one on, really, guys, like, just to reiterate, we don't let people just, like, get up and start speaking on behalf of the Spirit in our churches. No one is allowed to preach or teach in our congregations unless they are rightly called to do so. You know, they just get this type of reiteration. And basically what they're saying is, this is Christianity. No need for this sort of crisis. This is Christianity. This is the old Christianity.
We've retained even, classical or, you know, Christian worship, and we've retained the sacraments as essential to worship.
We've kept everything that's useful for good order. You get that line in there. You know, we've retained as many of the practices as we can that aren't erring, and retained everything that's useful for good order in the church. So you get that, and I think there's a bit of a like, What the heck do you mean? We thought you guys were going to come here with devil horns and speaking in tongues, and that's not what happens. The response to the Augsburg Confession, but the last seven articles are pretty scathing at points, repudiation of some Roman Catholic errors, mostly in practice, as practice influences theology, right, as it always does. Theology ought to be the determiner. Good theology ought to be the determiner of practice. But so often that goes backwards, and bad practices lead to bad theology. And so that's, you know, the argument that's happening there. There's a whole, like, lex orandi, lex credendi argument in there that I like to have fun with. But
it is a very fine line with all of that stuff.
Yeah. And so they, you know, Roman Catholics take it. They're like, oh, well, we're going to get to the bottom of this. And so they put their best people on it. And they come up with something called the Confutation. And the emperor sees the Confutation. He's like, oh, this is just garbage. Like, get some more of your best people in there and take a second crack at it, right? So they take another crack at it and send it back to the emperor. And he's like, if this is the best you got. And so... kind of the best they got gets sent out, you know, read back to them at the Diet. And again, so they took the copy of the Augsburg Confession, wouldn't give it back. And then they wrote a confutation and read it, but wouldn't hand it over for examination. And basically they write it. It kind of does, for the most part, you know, article by article. You're fine on this one. Like, they're, when it's like Article 1 is basically creedal Christianity, where they can say, like, oh, we hate every section of this. No, they're like, yeah, we're fine with that.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of those points where it's like the Reformation didn't change the doctrine of God, even if it reordered how it's confessed it's taught, or how it's proclaimed in light of justification.
Yeah.
It didn't actually change like the rote truths that are handed down in the creator scripture about God.
Yeah. So they read it. You know, there's, again, some very scurrilous like repudiation of evangelical doctrine as presented in the Agasana in the Confutation. And they don't hand it over, but you know, there's enough research interns along with the people the theologians at Augsburg that they managed to piece together full copies of it, so that Melanchthon can talk about it, and Luther too can just like write horrible things about how stupid the Catholic theologians are and what a horrible document it is. Melanchthon always likes to get digs in on their Latin too, so you get some of that. Melanchthon, anytime he reads anybody else's Latin, he's like,
trash.
Your Latin sucks. So he starts every time he gets in this big thing with Matthias Flaccius later on in life, and every letter it's like, well, you know,
I can barely understand what you're writing.
If your Latin were better, I could understand your argument. But since it's so horrible, I barely understand what you're trying to say. And so it's a lot of that in there. And Luther is just like, this is horrible. This is the excrement of the Antichrist, you know, and he kind of gets his normal Luther bombast in there.
Yeah, yeah.
And so eventually the evangelicals get on, like people like Melanchthon get on their little donkeys, and put their books on their lap and start riding back to home. Melanchthon is then commissioned by his elector to write a response to the Confutation, which he does, and it's called the Apology to the Augsburg Confession, or much like, you know, Christian apologetics, not I'm sorry for writing the Augsburg Confession. I'm sorry for writing this document that it'll become foundational to all of Christian thought from 1530 on, but a defense of what he said, a more drawn out defense of what he said. The Augsburg Confession itself, you know, each article is maybe somewhere between a paragraph and four. I don't remember exactly, but maybe five paragraphs on the long side. The apology is much longer. Much more in depth, many more quotations in the apology, church fathers, scripture, that type of thing. And the apology is amazing. I mean, the apology is just, the Augsburg Confession is a work of art, I think. It's a work of confessional art, and the apology shows you how brilliant the artist was too. Mm. Because it's just for somebody to be able to write that work of art that is as concise as it is in the Augsburg Confession.
Yeah, it's a very concise document.
And then to expand on it in the manner which he does in the apology, and have the same strain of the consistent argument coming across article to article in extended form. That's not easy. Those aren't usually the same people. Like the person that can write the systematic theology isn't always the same guy that can write a great blog, you know, and it's sort of like you kind of get the...
Yeah, he has the ability to do brevity and length.
Yeah, and that's just not... It just shows you how brilliant he really was, because he's just got... He's got the depth to do both things. You know, he's a conciliarist at points, sure. He's wimpier than Luther. Yeah, absolutely. He's not as brave, you know, publicly, and or as bombastic. Absolutely not. But he's brilliant. And and you want to know who knew he was brilliant? Luther knew he was brilliant.
Yeah.
When he literally says, oh, theology, pish-pash, I defer such matters to Master Philip. You know? So Luther's literally at times like, you want to ask me about the Old Testament? That's great.
Yeah.
You want to ask me about theology, though? Theology? I'm going to defer to Master Philip on theology.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is, we talk about this regularly on the show, and I think, you know, 1517, in a Lutheran world, spends more time on Melanchthon than probably almost any other group of people. You know, when you start to...
Well, we do, that's for sure.
We do. I mean, I think Melanchthon's the second most important to the entirety of the Protestant Reformation.
He's probably, that's one, absolutely true. That's almost not contestable.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say it's not contestable because I hate when people say that, like, about climate change.
But let's
so go ahead and try to contest it, but I believe you're right.
I mean, let's say this. Like, the Reformed need Luther and Melanchthon more than Lutherans need Calvin for anything to make sense. And, I mean...
Well, you could easily say Lutheranism is more reliant on Melanchthon than Calvinism ever was on Beza, maybe. Now, maybe Jeff Mallinson could correct us on that, but to my understanding, that's the case.
But even in the history of their reform, they need Luther and Melanchthon.
Yes, I understand what you're saying.
In a way that we don't need Calvin.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, yeah, we don't need Calvin.
I mean, yeah, at all. Melanchthon, baby.
There's a difference between being able to appreciate Calvin and saying that as a movement, you know, as a theological understanding of the scripture, you need Calvin.
No, but there's a reason, like... Lutherans and, you know, I love our Reform listeners, but there's a reason Lutherans always are having to be on guard for the Reformed taking Luther and Melanchthon and sort of like trying to make them theirs, like all the time. Like all the time I see this.
Well, when's the last time you saw like a Lutheran theologian known for their Luther studies all of a sudden releasing a YouTube series on Calvin?
Yeah,
you don't see that a lot.
Or a book on Calvin.
Or as you see the other one all the time.
Constantly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, the Lutherans gave over Melanchthon to the Calvinists for like 100 years. They're like, have him.
Yeah, well, they're right. He's a crypto-Calvinist. Take him anyway. And it's like, that's really silly.
Yeah, no. And, you know.
If anything, you might want to say that Calvin was a crypto-Melanchthonian.
Yeah.
Not that Melanchthon was a crypto-Calvinist.
Yeah, I think that's a better way of putting it. So, Melanchthon is very, very important to the Reformation, and his relationship with Luther and his work with Luther is often understated. And there's only a couple places where, people are not understating that and actually sort of revealing just how essential he was. And the Augsburg Confession is one of those moments where, was he less brave than Luther would have been in that same situation? Sure. Did he get the work done in an amazing way? Yeah.
Well, did he still go?
Yeah.
That's the question. I don't think the question, I'm not a combat veteran of any type, but I've heard them talk, and it seems like it's not whether or not you were scared, but whether you still went.
Yeah.
You know, whether you still showed up to the firefighter or to the patrol or whatever. Was he scared? Yeah, he was scared. Did he show up? Yes. Mm-hmm. Every time. Literally every time. Every time he was called upon to show up anywhere. And told by his elector to go there and do this.
He got on a donkey and went.
And we're talking like a donkey like from Shrek, like a little tiny, not like one of these big burros.
Is there a picture of that? Like, did somebody draw that?
No, but there's references to it in correspondence all the time. Like, he's got this little donkey that's like stacks his pile of books on his lap and sits side saddle and goes all over Germany.
Wow.
Cart, too. I mean, Luther traveled in a cart. Donkey cart, though. Not a horse cart. Donkey cart.
A little more resilient, those donkeys.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a pretty good overview, exciting overview of Augsburg. And a great introduction to why we're going to read the Apology, too, and how they pair together.
Yeah, and it'll be fairly easy to sort of note the expansions of certain articles in the Apology without having to go through both of them. And I'd say if people want to follow along, they could just easily follow along in the Augsburg Confession.
Yeah, that'd be good.
Yeah.
So, thanks for listening to this episode. I think next time, if you join us, you may want to read. I think, you know, if you have time this week, it would be probably worth it to read the Augsburg Confession before next episode.
Yeah,
and that would be very doable.
Block out some time. It might take you 45 minutes.
Yeah, it might take you. Yeah. So, definitely would be worth it. It's available online for free. If you don't have a Book of Concord, I'll put some links to various places.
Have we done this already? Because my memory... What does General Goldberg always say? Time is a flat circle. have we done a, like, hey, if you're going to order Book of Concord, like the various editions?
We did talk about it the last time, I think. We've talked about the availability of the readers and the Kolbwanger and then some of the
I just don't want people to get put off by, like, order Book of Concord. Order the one that you think you'll be able to read as easily, you know, most easily, and don't fret too much about the rest.
I wouldn't fret about which Book of Concord you have. I mean, they're all perfectly usable translations.
It's saying, you know, somebody saying, well, don't order a Bible because you might order the wrong translation. Like, just order the Bible, man. Just order, just get your Book of Concord. It's between like used versions of Tapper and what you can probably get one pretty cheap these days, I would guess.
Yeah, and I would say don't let people tell you that like there's like bad versions out there.
There's really not.
Yeah, there's really not. They're all usable translations. Yeah. So, all right, cool. We will catch you next time. Thanks for listening. Bye.